CSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor, Stanford University, Palo Alto, California. In the midst of the genius of the digital age these last decades, and yet Stanford University troubled now by incidents, serial incidents, that add up to puzzlement about Stanford and its present administration, its present opinion of the world outside of the leafy and balmy and beautiful campus. I welcome Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, who is also at the same time a happy graduate of Stanford University. Victor, good evening to you. Writing in American Greatness, you take us through several notes that suggest that Stanford has either lost its way or needs guidance. Most notably, the incident at the Stanford Law School recently, which has gained national attention, but is still alarming each time I walk through it. What happened, and why do you believe it happened? Good evening to you.
Good evening. There was a lot of reasons that explain this catastrophic chain of events that we saw at the law school, where a federal judge was shouted down and people called him scum and disrupted it. The diversity czars hijacked the lecture and took over the podium and then chastised the lecturer himself. And I mean, I outlined in the article about 8 or 9 incidents, and they're very striking. I mean, part of it, John, is that there's $9 trillion of market capitalization next door in Silicon Valley, which Stanford birthed. So there's no consequences because if you look at the interchanges, the mutual boards, a number of Stanford people who are on internet boards, Silicon Valley boards, Silicon Valley people that are on Stanford boards, and the cross-fertilization, there is so much money there that things that we think are so egregious that would hurt the reputation and eventually its $35 billion endowment don't exist because they're flush with cash. So there's a sense of entitlement, and there's very young people there who graduate or feel they will graduate into $400,000 or $500,000 a year jobs. So there's a sense of entitlement. They have gone to what we would call compensatory or reparatory admissions, in which they feel that the old proportional representation, where they tried to mirror image of the demographic of the United States, is not enough in the post-George Floyd period. So, and that was before George Floyd as well. So in the case of the demographic, just to take one of white, so-called white people, and I don't like to use those terms in today's multiracial society, but it's their terms coming from their website. They list 22%. Somewhere the demographic says 67 to 69% are white, and there's an overrepresentation. If I could say use that word, again, their word, not mine, it's about 52% women. So you're talking about 11%, 10%, 9% white males on campus. And out of that has to come the athletes and the legacies. These are people with long ties to Stanford who want their children to go there, and donors. And so what you've essentially done, John, is you've disenfranchised the white working class. They don't exist at Stanford. And to that extent, that's unfortunate because it reinforces this attack on meritocracy and also attack on the lower middle classes. And then finally, I think this is very important. They dropped the SAT test, and they made it optional, and they will not release the scores of people who chose to take it and sent it in, but and were admitted. They don't want to do that. But John, they do release the fact that of those who took the SAT, and I don't think you and I, if we took it today, could get a perfect score. I couldn't.
No.
But they rejected 60 to 70% in the last few years of those with perfect SAT scores. Just 5 to 10 years ago, Stanford used to brag that they had the highest SAT, highest GPA. And so by their own standards that they said made them such a global standout, they have now attacked them, and they won't tell us what the criteria are to get into Stanford, but it's not achievement on an SAT or ACT score. And we don't know what the GPA is either. And so they're very selective in what they release. And there's a sense of entitlement.
Yeah.
And it's part of the woke general national mood as well, as we saw with the shout down.
When I arrived on campus in 2003, the first time I'd ever been there, a Hoover Institution invited me to be a media fellow. I thought, what a paradise. How wonderful. And meeting the faculty, your colleagues at Hoover, Everybody extremely careful and polite, well-mannered, taking up pursuits around the world. You know, Hoover has all directions, all disciplines. And I was privileged to be there. But at the same time, California, I thought, what a great working environment. They don't have to shovel snow. Since then, I've learned that what you're talking about at Stanford is not limited to Stanford. In other words, this isn't a one-off. My university, Princeton University, has been through a bad patch too, removing Woodrow Wilson's name. Is that an explanation? We're just in a bad moment?
Well, it's different than the 60s revolution. That was a bottom-up cultural revolution. This is a top-down elite revolution. What I mean, John, is people are not marching on the dean's office as they did in the 60s, or marching on the Pentagon, or marching on the corporate headquarters. The woke change and revolution, this equality of mandatory result, that's coming from the corporate boardroom, from the dean, from the president, downward. So when you look at Stanford Law School, one of the law professors who these students emulate attacked Barron Trump, a 13-year-old kid at the impeachment hearing, as a witness. Another one attacked Johnny Depp and said she wished he died, would die, and that his body would be eaten by rats. The Bankman-Fried parents, who were under suspicion that they were much more intimately involved with Sam Bankman-Fried, who now is just a few blocks away on campus under house arrest, were Stanford law professors. Sam Bankman-Fried was allowed to stay home because of a bond posted by the former Stanford law dean. His chief financial officer, you remember Carolyn Ellison, who turned state's evidence and pled guilty to five counts of conspiracy, of money laundering, bank fraud, etc. She was a Stanford graduate. Elizabeth Holmes was a Stanford graduate. And the Theranos, not a graduate, but a dropout. But she had a lot of members of the Stanford community on her board of overseers on that Theranos Ponzi scheme. So what I'm getting at is these are elite people. It reflects, again, this marriage between huge amounts of money in the case of Theranos or Sam Bankman-Fried, or what his mother, the law professor, was doing, bundling money from Silicon Valley, kind of dark money, and dispersing it to left-wing candidates, or the father who was involved in the $16 million real estate. So money is a constant, but the other idea is that they are elites. They believe they know better. They're not subject to the consequences of their own ideology, and they feel that the money of the Silicon Valley and the Stanford veneer of prestige gives them a sense of entitlement.
Is it a moment here where it can be corrected with better leadership or good leadership? I'm looking for what can be done and not to just...
Yeah, I am too. I am too. The president, where we look is obviously the president. The president is under investigation for ethics violation of an article he wrote 30 years ago. And I think it was unfair that they're bringing that up. But almost every day in the Stanford Daily, the student newspaper, they're calling for his resignation. The law dean, you would think, could maybe set an example. But when she apologized to Judge Duncan, they tried to intimidate her. The students lined the corridor and made her walk through a kind of Game of Thrones hall of shame. And then they walked out. Two-thirds of the students walked out of her law class. So I think the administrators are terrified what they have wrought. They have created a sense on that campus that their main mission is not excellence in education or civic education or character building, but it's a Jacobin revolution. And these students, getting the cue from the faculty and the administrators, feel that they're exempt. It's a very strange combination, John, between elitism and Marxism. When they yell at Judge Duncan, you could not even get into Stanford.
Right, right.
And I wanted to say to them, well, wait a minute. You used to brag I couldn't pick up a paper without hearing that you had 95%, 96% of your graduates pass the bar in the first try, and you were so elite. But now, this year, they have announced that 14% of Stanford students flunked the bar. That's unheard of. 14% flunked the bar in their first try. So they're not elite anymore. And this is going to continue, this dismantling of standards, until the name Stanford will not be synonymous with the great Stanford we all remember. That it really birthed the California mid-20th century miracle, the university's research and science, medicine, professional schools, along with Berkeley. Those two twin rival universities were globally singular and they helped Northern California become what it was. And now they're operating in reverse and they're helping California devolve.
Is it possible, just in the 30 seconds, is it possible the faculty is an answer? Are they going to come together and say?
There's some very courageous people on the faculty. I know some of them, and they are outspoken and they're appalled, but they're in a minority. Right. But some of the people, they have to have great courage because they're harassed personally and professionally. And yet they're trying to bring it back to its sanity and restore the name of Stanford right. and the standards that made it what it was.
Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution, a very happy Stanford graduate who writes at American Greatness about the present troubles. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Thank you, Victor.
Thank you, John. Much.
And talk to you next week, Guy. I hope we have a happier
okay.
Sunday. Bye.
Me too. Yeah, bye.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.